Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane Rehm. Before we begin our segment, let me give you a quick update on Diane. She's recuperating well from her accident. She expects to be moving from the hospital to rehab tomorrow, and she hopes to be back with you, her loyal listeners, real soon. Since the U.S. began a war on terror in the wake of the September 11 attacks 8 years ago, more than 5,000 members of the U.S. military have died in Iraq and in and around Afghanistan. Joining me in the studio to talk about current U.S. objectives toward Iraq and Afghanistan, Stephen Biddle of the Council on Foreign Relations and Ambassador James Dobbins of the RAND Corporation, who during the Bush administration was special envoy, the president's special envoy in Afghanistan. And by phone from Vermont, David Sanger, who is the chief Washington correspondent of the New York Times and author of the new book, The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts and the Challenges to American Power. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us on the Diane Rehm Show.
Pleasure.
Thank you, Steve.
You can join us as well at 1-800-433-8850 or send us an email, drshow@wamu.org. Find us on Facebook, send us a tweet, join this conversation. David, as I mentioned the numbers, we're now close to 200,000 American troops stationed in these two countries. Casualties at 5,000, deaths at 5,000, wounded over 30,000. What is the situation in these two countries from the point of view of the deployment of American troops? Give us an overview.
Well, Steve, as you know, of course, in Iraq, our troop numbers are coming down, and it's actually that reduction that has given President Obama the opportunity to increase troops in Afghanistan, and in Afghanistan we have now added about 17,000, we're at a little over 60,000 there. Politically, however, the Afghanistan operation is getting, I think, far more challenging for President Obama. At this point, the number of casualties that we've suffered in Afghanistan has begun to exceed the number in Iraq. And there's a lot of question about what our strategy is there. You know, this reminds you in many ways of those darkest days of 2006, before the surge in Iraq, when President Bush was under almost daily questioning about whether or not we had a strategy that, A, could win, which was his defined objective, or in President Obama's case, whether we have a strategy in which we could defeat what his own strategy paper issued in March says we need to do, which is defeat al-Qaeda and its associates. Of course, al-Qaeda isn't a big force, almost non-existent in Afghanistan. It's in Pakistan. But the Taliban have, as Admiral Mullen said on one of the talk shows yesterday, they are continuing to make progress. Our situation is continuing to deteriorate.
Now, James Dobbins, picking up on that comment, Admiral Mullins used some pretty strong language, serious, deteriorating. What's behind those words?
I think what's behind those words is that for the last couple of years, the level of violence has been going up. The level of support is measured in opinion polls and by other means of the population for the government, for the U.S. presence, for the NATO presence has been going down. It's still not low. The level of support for both the president, the government, and for the NATO and American presence is still relatively high, much higher than it ever was in Iraq. But the trend lines are all bad. The violence is going up. It's still not anything like what it was in Iraq 2 years ago. The trend lines are all bad. And so Mullen is reflecting more the trend lines than the actual level of violence or level of support.
Now, explain to me, Stephen Biddle, what's behind this trend line? You know, Americans, last time many people tuned into Afghanistan, the Taliban were vanquished. It was a great victory. What is behind the resurgence of this violence?
Well, I think there are two primary underlying problems that have given rise to the trends that we were just talking about. One is a lack of security infrastructure. Too few security forces, either by the government of Afghanistan or from the West or the outside, which creates a security vacuum and makes an opportunity for insurgents to take root in Afghanistan. The other central underlying problem is poor governance, which gives entree to insurgents in the sense that to quell an insurgency of this kind, you need both enough security personnel that civilians who know who concealed insurgents are and who they aren't feel safe telling the government or telling us or telling the authorities who they are. But you also need the civilians in the area to feel an incentive to do so, in the sense that they actively prefer the government to the presence of the insurgents, and hence, if they feel safe, they will provide the tips. Right now, we have a problem where too few of them feel safe, and we're increasingly, in some parts of the country, especially the South, too few of them are inclined to provide the
information. And in fact, The Economist, in a major piece, a cover piece in the, on Afghanistan this week, made the argument that in some ways the American presence has been counterproductive, that it's that a lot of American troops insensitive to native customs, particularly the status of women, that they that in some ways American policy has actually helped the insurgents recruit, and that a lot of ordinary people in Afghanistan do not want the American troops there.
Well, there are a lot of things we could do to help make our presence less burdensome on Afghan civilians, but I don't go as far as some do with the argument that foreign troops per se create an antibody response, that this hostility to foreigners will inevitably be resisted by Afghans. For most of the time that we've been there, our presence has actually been quite popular, if the polls are an accurate reflection of public sentiment. I think what we've got going on at the moment is inevitably a foreign military presence is a burden. Inevitably, people don't like it. They tolerate it, however, if in exchange it provides security. What we've got at the moment is a situation in which a burdensome foreign presence is not providing security. So you get both the inconvenience of having a foreign military around and the violence created by the insurgents. And given that, people are understandably very dissatisfied.
And David, one of the key factors here is General Stanley McChrystal, president's representative, is now engaged in a top-down review, thorough review of the American presence there, and you expect he will ask for even more troops in Afghanistan sometime in the next few weeks when he reports to the president?
Well, this is a fascinating question, and I think on some elements, the governance elements of this, I think Mr. Biddle was helping along in some of those reviews, if I've read his material right. The big question that I think faces General McChrystal is trying to balance what he believes his strategic needs are with what's been made clear the president's political needs are here. There's been continuous reporting over the past few months of signals being sent from the administration saying, we gave you everything you asked for with the 17,000 troops. Don't come back asking for more. That has morphed over the past few weeks to an expectation that he may ask for 10,000 to 20,000 more.
Let me interrupt you just training. Let me just interrupt you quickly, because John McCain over the weekend said on TV shows that in fact there were pressures from people around President Obama on General McChrystal to downsize his recommendations.
I have heard those reports as well. We've certainly seen that in between our reporting in Afghanistan, where every time Times reporters go out and talk to the commanders on the ground, Helene Cooper has a very good story on this morning in the Times, the commanders all say, look, if we're going to accomplish the mission you have in mind, we're going to need significantly more troops. And yet you hear a reluctance in Washington for all of the usual reasons. And that's going to be, I think, one of the toughest decisions that President Obama is going to have to make, and may have more to do with how his presidency is remembered than the health care debate.
James Dobbins, let me read you a line from this Economist article. It says, it seems clear that the international effort to bring stability to Afghanistan, in which a strong, somewhat liberal democratic state can take root, is failing. True?
I think that's something of an overstatement. I think it's true that it's not progressing as quickly as many people had hoped, perhaps somewhat unrealistically. The problem is that from 2001, when we, with the aid of local supporters, overran Afghanistan and expelled the Taliban, until 2005 or 2006, we vastly under-resourced this effort. You know, in 2002, when we had an opportunity to stabilize the country, we had only 8,000 troops in there. The amount of assistance that the United States provided Afghanistan in 2002 was something like under $500 million. That's less than 1/20 what we're providing today. So for those first couple of years, as we shifted our focus to Iraq, and as we naively believed that Afghanistan could be stabilized without any significant commitment of American resources, we missed a major opportunity and allowed the Taliban to resuscitate.
Quickly, before we take a break, Steve, one of the key events here in Afghanistan was the election recently. Hamid Karzai, the man who was installed in that period that James Dobbins was just talking about, running for re-election, his main opponent, Abdullah Abdullah, former foreign minister, now saying there was widespread fraud. We don't know what the results will be several days before we know anything. But what's your sense of, on the ground, the situation surrounding the election?
Well, I mean, I think there's potential for a substantial amount of instability resulting from the election. I mean, the worst-case scenario here would be an Iran-like outcome in which it was widely believed that the election was thrown. I think at the moment we don't know either how much fraud there was. I'm sure there will be at least some, possibly great deal. And we also don't know what the reaction will be among the Afghan people to whatever the fraud turns out to have been. This is all changing as we speak.
And the administration has a good deal riding on an outcome that is widely seen as credible.
Yes.
That's Stephen Biddle from the Council on Foreign Relations. Ambassador James Dobbins with me. David Sanger from the New York Times. I'm Steve Roberts sitting in for Diane today. And we'll be back with your calls and your questions in just a minute, so stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts sitting in today for Diane, and my guest this hour, Stephen Biddle of the Council on Foreign Relations, Ambassador James Dobbins of the RAND Corporation, David Sanger of the New York Times, and our subject is Iraq and Afghanistan, and an update on both of those. Give us a call, 1-800-433-8850, drshow@wamu.org is our email address. And David, one of the other key factors here is that President Obama, speech to the veterans of foreign wars recently, gave a very strong statement saying, in effect, our American national interest is engaged in Afghanistan in a way it was not, in his view, engaged in Iraq. And at the very same time that he seems to be raising the stakes and identifying very strongly with this mission, for the first time, public opinion polls have showed a majority, 50% of Americans, saying the war in Afghanistan is not worth fighting. What's your take on why Obama is placing so much emphasis on Afghanistan and how he has to pay attention to public opinion?
Well, Steve, I thought the most interesting line that he used in that speech last Monday, it was just a week ago today, was he said, "We must never forget this is not a war of choice, this is a war of necessity." Now, throughout the campaign, he said, and I think it helped him win the presidency, he said that Iraq was a war of choice. It was not directly related to 9/11. There was a perceived threat that we now think was probably far more remote than than the Bush administration sold it at the time, and it was clearly a war of choice. Afghanistan in 2001 was, I think, clearly a war of necessity in that it was Afghanistan that had, of course, harbored and trained al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. The question is it a war of necessity now, and is it perceived as a war of necessity still in the United States nearly 8 years after 9/11? And that's the public opinion problem that I think President Obama is facing. He views it as a war of necessity, he said, because we have to make sure that Afghanistan can never again be used as a launching grounds for an attack on the United States. But there are all kinds of ways to do that. And if the mission now is to completely administer the country and train everybody to run the place themselves, then it requires a certain force level. If the mission is simply to make sure that it's never a launching ground again, a lot of people are saying, could we pull back and do that with remotely fired missiles? Can we do that with better intelligence? Do we need to have this level on the ground? And he has not yet fully addressed that question, even in that speech.
And James Dobbins, David is pointing at a very important question. What is the goal of this administration? How is success defined? Is it containing the direct threat to the United States in terms of insurgents organizing attacks? Or is it a much larger and more ambitious concept of nation building and creating a stable and somewhat democratic country? Is that part of the problem here, that the public doubts are reflecting that there seems to be a confusion of objectives?
Well, I think one needs to make a distinction between the reason we're there and our overall national objective on the one hand, and the instruments we're employing to achieve that objective. Mm-hmm. The president has made pretty clear that our objective is to deny Afghanistan and Pakistan as sanctuaries from which extremists can plot and organize attacks on the United States and on other friendly countries.
That's where the core national interest gets engaged.
That's why we're there. Mm-hmm. It's why we intervened mm-hmm. in the first place. We basically were attacked from Afghanistan. We want to make sure it doesn't happen again. Mm-hmm. Okay, how do you achieve that? Well, assuming you don't want to garrison the place forever, you achieve it by trying to leave behind a government that's capable of securing its territory and preventing people from engaging in those kinds of activities. So to some degree, nation building, that is creating an effective capacity for self-government and control of national territory, is essential, both in Afghanistan and in Pakistan. And so our objectives in that regard, our instrumental objectives, if you will, have to be pretty broad. Otherwise, we'll have to stay there forever. Now, David indicated that some people think we can just stand back and preempt these kinds of attacks by disrupting them with cruise missiles or predator strikes. That was essentially the Clinton policy, and we did conduct cruise missile strikes on Afghanistan periodically during the Clinton administration, and it proved to be entirely ineffective as a deterrent or a preventive to 9/11.
The other word, Steve Biddle, that we're hearing more and more when it comes to Afghanistan is Vietnam. New York Times yesterday, major piece by White House correspondent Peter Baker saying, will Afghanistan become Obama's Vietnam? And the parallel that people were drawing in that article is playing off exactly what James Dobbins was saying. In order to accomplish the first objective of removing the threat, you start escalating the mission on the ground, and people are saying, wait, this is going way beyond our objectives. Your take on that analogy?
Well, there's almost a reflex in the United States to compare the conduct of any war that isn't going well in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
You can take any two randomly selected historical cases, and there will be some things in common and many, many things that aren't. And it seems to me that the things that aren't in common between Vietnam and Afghanistan are also pretty important. The ideology, for example, that the Taliban are advancing in Afghanistan is, by all accounts, very unpopular in the overwhelming majority of the parts of Afghanistan. the size of the insurgent forces radically smaller than the Viet Cong were. The sophistication of the opposition is lower in many ways than the Viet Cong was. Our methods are very different. There are many things that are different as well as similar between Vietnam and Afghanistan. I think the issue here is if the end outcome is the same, this would clearly be very unfortunate for U.S. national security interests, for the Obama administration politically, for Afghans for that matter. So if you think that this enterprise in Afghanistan is going to fail, and it's going to fail even if we reinforce and do the other things that the Obama administration has been doing, then I suppose you could say that the key parallel to Vietnam, failure, holds. But so many of the details are different that I'm not sure how useful the comparison is.
And, of course, just the scale of American involvement is enormously different. 68,000 troops on the ground compared to 500,000 at the peak. But the other analogy that people are drawing in terms of trying to draw a parallel, you're talking about an Asian country with a Western military force. People say the French tried it in Vietnam, they failed. The Americans tried it in Vietnam, they failed. There's a long history of outsiders, the British in the 19th century, the Russians in the 20th century, now the Americans in the 21st century in Afghanistan. And people are saying that's one of the ways in which there's a very uncomfortable echo or parallel.
Well, I mean, counterinsurgency generally, Vietnam, Afghanistan, anywhere else, is very, very hard and often fails. I mean, the aggregate success rate historically in the modern era, at least for counterinsurgency, is usually thought to be in the neighborhood of 25%. So the enterprise we are engaged in Afghanistan is very challenging, very difficult, has a substantial risk of failure, but that doesn't mean that failure is inevitable there. And the difference between success and failure in counterinsurgency is usually believed to be importantly influenced by the strategies and policies that the counterinsurgents adopt. And because there is a substantial empirical record of counterinsurgency, we hope we've learned things from it in ways that can make success relatively more likely in Afghanistan. But it's important to make the point here that nobody, not the administration, not its opponents, can guarantee what the outcome is going to be here. What this amounts to is you identify the strategy that you think is most likely to succeed, you give it whatever resources you can afford to give it, and you make some kind of calculated gamble. You take some degree of risk that you can secure your interest for the cost you're willing to expend. That's not a guarantee in any event. The success rate in counterinsurgency is a lot lower than 100%.
And I want to turn, given the most recent example of counterinsurgency efforts in the United States, of course, the ongoing battle in Iraq, where 130,000 troops, American troops, still there. But since David Sanger, since June 30th, they've been under orders not to, to leave the cities and turn over more responsibility to the Iraqi security forces. And yet in the last few weeks, a disturbing upsurge in violence, a number of car bombings, many casualties. What is that telling us about the ability of the Iraqi forces to actually guarantee security? Has there been a miscalculation with the withdrawal on June 30th? Give us your take.
So, Steve, the key question, obviously, is did we do this too soon? And the answer that American commanders give is, we did this when the Iraqis said we had to and when they believed they were ready. And almost all of the commanders in Iraq have been unanimous in the thought that you had to give the Iraqis a chance to determine whether, in fact, they could do this themselves, and that they would never actually train up and begin to take responsibility until they had responsibility. So it's the classic chicken and egg question out here. And so to some degree, we're supposed to hang back and watch and hope that they make this go and work. Now, President Obama has been very clear that by the end of 2011, we're gone from there. Mm-hmm. And it's no longer our problem. And I suspect that he's very sincere in that, particularly as Afghanistan gets more complex. It tells you that 2011 is going to be a pretty complicated year. Not as if next year is going to be easy. But the reason I say that is that we have now two deadlines that the president has set. He said by 2011 and 2011 we're out of Iraq. He's also said that we'll have to make an assessment after 18 months, which takes you to the beginning of 2011 in Afghanistan, about whether our strategy is working. And when you ask administration officials on background what happens if it's not, then you begin to get a version of these scenarios we were describing about pulling back and trying to keep everything at bay from a distance.
James Dobbins, weigh in here. One of the symbols of the aspirations of the Iraqi government of creating a zone of stability and being able to police the streets were these blast walls that were removed very ostentatiously, saying it's now a peaceful city. The blast walls protecting government buildings. We saw them being put back after these attacks. And Foreign Minister Kurd raised the question of whether, in fact, security forces were involved in planning these attacks. What's the evidence about that? And is this a sign of a growing sectarian violence in Iraq?
I think, first of all, the levels of violence in Iraq, although they have gone up, have not gone up to anything like the levels they were in 2006. There's no sign at this stage of a resuscitation, for instance, of al-Qaeda's influence or ability to destabilize the country. There are still a number of tensions in the country, including Sunni-Shia tensions and Arab-Kurdish tensions, which could become a source of larger-scale conflict. But so far, that hasn't happened. I think it seems clear that the Iraqi government moved somewhat too quickly to begin to alter security arrangements on the assumption that the levels of threat were lower than they in fact were. But what was interesting was that they seemed to have caught the person who was personally responsible for these huge car bombs within 48 hours of the perpetration, something we were never able to do. And so it's possible that they actually do have a better capacity to penetrate these kind of plots and roll up the networks.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. To follow up on that, you say, James Dobbins, that while there's some signs of growing sectarian violence, you seem to be reasonably optimistic that it's under control. Others have been more alarmed than you have been.
Well, so far the Shia population has not responded to these attacks with large-scale counterattacks the Sunni population. You haven't seen a resumption of the types of ethnic cleansing that took place in 2005 and 2006. That's partly because the people haven't come back to the neighborhoods that were cleansed, but it's also because they haven't been aroused to the same degree. Nevertheless, I think ethnic tensions are the division between the ethnicities and the religious groups in Iraq is greater than it is in Afghanistan. And so the potential for a more substantial civil war remains there. And it's one of the reasons that the U.S. is withdrawing in a graduated fashion.
And David Sanger, what's your take on how are you reading the latest upsurge? Are you worried about the growing possibility of civil strife among the, as James Dobbins said, you've got these very clearly defined groups, the Sunni and Shias, and then the Kurds in the north. What's your assessment here?
You have to be worried about it, but you go back to Ambassador Dobbins' initial question when we were discussing Afghanistan, which is, what's our national interest here?
Right.
Obviously, we had a commitment to do Iraq right because we went in and invaded, whether it was a good idea or a bad idea. That's what President Obama inherited and has to make a best faith effort to go do that. But at some point, you have to say, okay, it's your country, and turn it back over. And if, in fact, al-Qaeda in Iraq is not coming back in, if, in fact, Iraq does not create a broad strategic threat to us, at some point you have to say, why is it that we have a continued presence? Now, you know, we have had in our country, of course, a long history of keeping some presence in places that were perfectly peaceful and yet we had a strategic interest. We still have troops in Europe and in Germany. We still have them in Japan. They're a vestige of World War II. But that's an easy case politically to make because nobody's taking casualties. If we were taking casualties in Iraq on a continued basis, and we couldn't really explain what our strategic interest was anymore, apart from stopping a civil war, I think it would become politically problematic for the president.
Quickly, Steve Biddle, another key event here, imminent release of CIA reports on interrogation techniques in Iraq, likely to be highly critical. Could that have an effect on the situation there in terms of both Iraqi opinion and American opinion?
I think that depends importantly on whether or not there's a referendum in Iraq on our presence. There is renewed talk of putting to a public vote in Iraq whether or not the Status of Forces Agreement that both requires that we leave by 2011 but enables us to stay until 2011 is going to be held up. If that's put to a vote and this news release makes us even less popular, that could be politically problematic.
Good point. Steve Biddle, Ambassador James Dobbins, and David Sanger in New York Times. I'm Steve Roberts. I'm going to be back with your calls. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary, on the web at healthreform.org. By the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
What began with a handful of geeks has evolved into the pursuit of millions, how bloggers are breaking new ground in publishing, journalism, entertainment, and self-expression, and why blogging is here to stay. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. Our subject this hour, the ongoing strife in both Iraq and Afghanistan. Stephen Biddle, the Council of Foreign Relations, is with me in the studio. So is Ambassador James Dobbins of the RAND Corporation, who was President Bush's special envoy to Afghanistan. And by phone from Vermont, David Sanger of the New York Times, who has written The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts and the Challenges to American Power. 1-800-433-8850, our phone, and our email, drshow@wamu.org. I'm going to read some emails. Let's get some answers here. Keith from Silver Spring, Maryland, writes, James Dobbins, as a former special warfare sailor, he says, you cannot win a guerrilla war with conventional tactics. It's very difficult, impossible to beat a nationalistic force with an invading foreign force, period. You agree?
In principle, yes. I think it's very difficult to prevail in a counterinsurgency unless you have an indigenous partner who has credibility and significant capacity, which is why a principal part of the administration's current strategy is to double and perhaps even quadruple the size of the Afghan armed forces.
And during the first invasion of Afghanistan, there was a well-known alliance with Afghani forces, the Northern Alliance, who helped rout the Taliban. Has that alliance with those indigenous forces frayed over the years?
Well, as a matter of policy, the United States and the international community as a whole broke up the militias with which the United States had been allied when it overthrew the Taliban government and instead sought to build up an Afghan national army. I think there's a move now to combine this top-down strategy, not to abandon it, but to combine it with a bottom-up strategy in which you begin to build local civil defense forces in which people in villages and towns have some capacity to provide for their own defense, at least on a first responder basis.
Is that to some extent based on the success in Anbar province in Iraq of getting local forces to help police and patrol their own area?
Yes, I think many of the tactical changes that are currently being envisaged in Afghanistan are an effort to transpose to a somewhat different environment the successful tactics embarked on in Iraq in 2007.
And here's Harold from Novi, Michigan, writing, Steve Biddle, there are many articles and books which contend that the lifeblood of the insurgency in Afghanistan and Pakistan is the revenue from drug trafficking. Why is there so little mention of this and efforts to combat the drug traffickers?
Well, the Taliban clearly do get a fair amount of revenue from drug trafficking. It's a minority of the total revenue created by drug trafficking. Moreover, it's probably, we don't know exactly, but it's probably a minority of the Taliban's funding stream overall. They have substantial sources of income that are not just poppy farming within Afghanistan. Arguably, the single biggest challenge that the drug problem in Afghanistan poses to success of the coalition effort is less that it funds the Taliban and more that it contributes to the general problem of corruption and misgovernance in the country. The overwhelming majority of the proceeds from the drug traffic in Afghanistan go to other Afghans than the Taliban, in all likelihood, some of whom are associated with the Afghan government.
And to continue the subject of money, David, we also have an email from a listener who says, you know, conservatives in America say we don't have money for health care, and we've been literally not able to account for billions of dollars in Iraq and Afghanistan. We talked about the cost in terms of casualties, but talk about the cost in terms of money of the ongoing efforts in Afghanistan and Iraq as well.
Well, Iraq has, there are competing numbers around, but I think the sort of round number that you can think of is about $800 billion since we started. Afghanistan is has been less expensive so far, but just as the casualty numbers are beginning to exceed the Iraq numbers, the Pentagon's own budgeting for Afghanistan is beginning is ramping up quite significantly over the next 2 years, and you're hitting that crossing point already, where Iraq is coming down and Afghanistan is going up. It would be, I think, difficult for President Obama's opponents in Congress, Republicans in Congress, to make an argument now that we're spending too much money on this, considering the fact that when President Bush was in office, they obviously argued the other side of this. I think President Obama's big problem on the funding for this is going to come actually from his own party. And it's going to be linked to our earlier discussion of explaining strategic objectives in both countries. And I think that the harder time he has doing that, the more restrictions he's going to see placed on some of the funding.
But didn't
the other interesting thing to watch is how much we actually spend on governance and nation building.
And David, during the campaign, the president tried strongly to make the connection between the cost of Iraq and the lack of funds in the United States and the pressure was putting on the budget for domestic issues. Here's a man who, with health care and many other issues, wants to spend a lot on domestic programs. So at some point, does his commitment to building up forces in Afghanistan have an implication for his ability to spend money on domestic programs?
It certainly has a political implication. The fact of the matter is that the domestic programs we've been discussing, and certainly the programs related to the stimulus package and the economic recovery, have far outpaced anything we're paying for both wars combined. The public debt has increased about $1 trillion since the time that President Obama took office, and almost all of that is stimulus money, and none of that obviously is health care or anything since that time. So politically, it's a great talking point. The numbers don't really compare when you look at them statistically.
Let's turn to some of our callers who've been waiting in Maureen in Northern Michigan. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Oh, hello. Yes, I listen to your show all the time. I really like it. But considering this topic, the term insurgent keeps coming up over and over again, and it drives me crazy, to tell you the truth. I'm kind of wondering, is that pretty much anybody who opposes these occupations, or the U.S. occupation in Iraq and Afghanistan, and why isn't that addressed more often?
Okay, thanks. Steve Biddle.
Well, I mean, usually insurgent is just held to be somebody fighting against an established government. So by that literal definition, that's a sensible way to describe what's going on. I think the larger question of, is the U.S. presence in Afghanistan tolerable to Afghans, again, I think turns on whether or not we're producing anything in exchange that Afghans value. If we aren't, then I think we're going to be tremendously unpopular, and eventually the insurgency, if we want to call it that, will grow much, much larger than it is now.
And that relates to another email, James Dobbins, we have from Kathleen in Athens, Ohio. She says, I am in communication with a family in Afghanistan. They keep saying one of the only ways to deal with the Taliban is to engage the more moderate Taliban members. How often is the U.S. military trying to engage with these more moderate members of the Taliban?
Well, I think President Obama just recently reiterated his willingness and interest in engaging with those elements of the Taliban that are prepared to enter the Afghan political system. Again, as part of the effort...
Ambassador Holbrooke made that point very much over the weekend.
I guess it was Holbrooke over the weekend,
yeah.
Right. And Obama, in his March statement on Afghanistan, also talked about trying to work with reconcilable Taliban. And American military commanders have and will continue to try to co-opt local leaders, providing financial and other incentives to change their views and bring them over to the other side. The real question is, how many moderate Taliban are there, and in particular, whether the leadership of the several – there's not really one insurgency. There are several insurgencies – whether the top leadership of those insurgencies is amenable to any kind of deal. And I think the general view is that they're not, as long as they think they're winning. That if the war seems to turn against them, if they perceive that the long-term trends are going against their interests, then they may become more amenable to arrangements.
Let's turn to Bob in Durham, North Carolina. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show, Bob.
Hi, guys. I've got a couple quick points to make, and I'll take your answers off the air. First is I don't think that the Afghanis themselves have a vision for their future, and I'm wondering if anybody's considered showing them the Swiss model. Their countries have several similarities, both landlocked, mountainous, and have disparate ethnic groups. Yet Switzerland makes it work very well, and nobody seems to be saying to the Afghanis, "Hey, look at Switzerland. Try to imitate their model." Second point: there's the problem with the drugs, with the opium poppies. And I was wondering if anybody ever considered just co-opting that, letting them grow the crop, and then selling to the drug companies, see if they could do it more cost-effectively than it's being done now. I mean, there's a market for it legally, and can it be done? Those are my questions. I'll take your answers off the air.
Okay, thanks, Bob. David Sanger.
Well, on the drug question, there certainly has been discussion in the past, not only in Afghanistan but elsewhere. Would it make sense to just come in and buy out the entire crop? And one can argue about whether that's a good eradication strategy or whether it simply creates an incentive to harvest more of it. But as a political matter, asking the United States Congress to go in and spend American taxpayer money to buy opium after we have spent years in a war on drugs, I think is probably a difficult one. As for the Swiss model, well, you know, Steve Biddle made some absolutely dead-on points about the difficulty in comparing Afghanistan to Vietnam. There are a lot of points where there is no good analogy. And Afghanistan to Switzerland strikes me as even bigger of a leap.
Let's turn to Wally in Moultonboro, New Hampshire. Wally, welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking the call. I'm a first-time caller.
Welcome.
I have 3 points to make. I also have a son in Iraq right now on his second deployment. My first is kind of broad, and it has to do with the fact that I know you folks seek balance when you bring on people to your show to discuss these important topics. But I do get very discouraged when some of the NEOs that you bring on simply use it as a platform to bash the administration that's trying to do the best it can. Second point is, if Afghanistan had the oil that Iraq had, we'd have gone in there and stayed in there after 9/11. And we're just too quick, I think, to forgive the Bush administration and to try to blame everything on the current administration. One of your guests also said Al-Qaeda is not in Afghanistan. I think that's an incredible statement. The borders between Pakistan and Afghanistan are blurred. To say that with any degree of surety that Al-Qaeda is not in Afghanistan, I think is an absurd comment. There are two excellent books out right now. One is called The Horse Soldiers, and it deals with Afghanistan's problem, which and the way we dealt with it right after 9/11, The Horse Soldiers. The second one is dealing with Iraq, and it is The Forever War. The names of both authors at my age escape me, and I'm sorry about that, but they're both out on newsstands right now in bookstores.
Thank you, Wally.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Wally. Appreciate it. I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Steve Biddle, your reactions to Wally's comments.
Well, I agree with a fair amount of the implicit argument. I think, for example, if we had not invaded Iraq and if we had put anything like the resources we've put into Iraq, into Afghanistan, we would not now be facing an insurgency on the scale that we're facing there. And I think you can make a very strong argument that would have been a better policy. As far as Al-Qaeda...
And that was a long-standing debate going back many years in this country about where the real threat to American interests came from.
Well, that's right. And I think one of the ironies of Iraq is that the primary U.S. interest in Iraq was created by the invasion. Since 2003, the primary U.S. interest at stake in Iraq has been that the war not spread to the rest of the region, which is of tremendous importance to the international economy. That's a threat we created by invading the country in 2003. It's real now that we've done it, but it wouldn't have been real if we
hadn't
done it.
And also American prestige and power acquired a life of its own once American commitment was made there.
Yes, that's right. And as far as Al-Qaeda not being in Afghanistan, Al-Qaeda has, as far as we know, very little physical presence on the Afghan side of the Durand Line. But as the president has pointed out, there is an important issue with respect to Al-Qaeda's ability to strike the United States that is connected to the question of what happens in Afghanistan in a variety of ways, partly through the possible use of Afghan soil as a potential base in the future, partly as a result of the stability of Pakistan, which is importantly affected by what happens on the other side of the Durand Line.
And isn't one of the dangers here that if you effectively drive the Taliban out of Afghanistan and their Al-Qaeda, whatever, how many Al-Qaeda allies they have, where are they going to go? They're going to go to Pakistan, which could have a destabilizing effect there, a country which, to the view of many, actually is more important to American national interest in Afghanistan, given the fact that they possess nuclear weapons.
Well, there are countervailing effects here. I mean, one possible consequence of success in Afghanistan might be to drive Taliban into Pakistan. It's important to distinguish, though, between local mm-hmm, Taliban mm-hmm. and Taliban cadres. Many mm-hmm. of the Taliban's actual combatants in Afghanistan are locals from the villages where they're fighting. They're rather unlikely to pick up stakes, move to Pakistan, fight a war there. The cadre that can move back and forth across the border is a part, but not the totality, of what we're dealing with in Afghanistan. That's the part that, if anything, would move. The bigger issue, it seems to me, is if the Karzai government falls and is replaced by some sort of neo-Taliban Quetta-Shura alternative, you could then create in a substantial fraction of Afghanistan's current territory and with whatever resources are available within Afghanistan, a base camp for insurgent activity against Pakistan. Pakistan has a real-life nuclear arsenal. That is where Al-Qaeda Global is based. It's fighting an insurgency right now and is generally thought to be unstable. It seems to me that in many ways the most important interest that the United States has at stake in this region is the security of Pakistan and the effect that Afghanistan has on that.
Steve, can I interject?
Yes, please.
I think that that Mr. Biddle is absolutely correct on this, and we've discussed this some before on the show. I think one of the great hard realities here is that we're pouring our troops into Afghanistan because we can, and we can't put them into Pakistan. if you were designing this war in a way that, you know, was sort of ideal, you probably would have a significant force presence against al-Qaeda and against Taliban over the Pakistani border. But we can't, which is why we are left with the strategy that we've been pursuing, which is mostly...
We can't, David, because the Pakistanis won't allow us?
That's right. That's right. And because there are huge sensitivities on the side of the Pakistani government, which won't allow us, because we also have a great concern about the stability of those nuclear weapons, and so we can't let the Pakistani people turn against us as well. And every time we do a strike into Pakistan, we obviously create a big reaction.
That's going to have to be the last word. That's David Sanger, Chief Washington Correspondent in the New York Times. Steve Biddle has been with me as well from the Council on Foreign Relations, and Ambassador James Dobbins from the RAND Corporation. Thank you all for being with us. I'm Steve Roberts sitting in today for Diane, and thank you so much for spending part of your morning with us.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.